Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day, we start back in 1875. Outlaw Billy the Kid would be arrested for the very first time on this day. Interestingly enough, he would escape 2 days later. Wasn't a very effective arrest, if you ask me. In 1913, on this day, a gentleman by the name of Roland Garros would fly over the Mediterranean Sea. Yes, the person whom the French Open is named after was an aviator. On the same day, in the same year, in 1913, Charlotte Matleka would lead a protest of women against the imposition of women's passes in the Free State on this day. In 1923, on this day, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was essentially founded by Abdulaziz Saud, who founded it as a merger between two regions that we now know today as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In 1961, on this day, a show called How to Marry a Millionaire would premiere on a television series. It was a movie initially, then turned into a TV series. Speaking of TV series, a couple of them started on this day. In 1962, The Jetsons would premiere, the first ever color TV series. In 1980, on this day, Bob Marley would have his last concert in Pittsburgh. In 1983, on this day, Gerry Coetzee would become the first South African WBA heavyweight champion after having defeated Michael Doakes in the 10th round. In 1994, on this day, the Shawshank Redemption movie would be released. 2003, we got NCIS. 2009, we got Modern Family. In 2012, the Iranian government would decide to block the use of Google as a search engine. In 2017, President Donald Trump would get upset that Stephen Curry would turn his invitation down, and as a result would uninvite the NBA champions at the time, the Golden State Warriors, to the White House. Initially he had invited them, changed his mind. 2019, on this day, Greta Thunberg would yell at people in New York City. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today we are taking a look at the government of a national unity as we reflect on 100 days of the GNU. We're going to be taking a look at it from a business perspective. What has it achieved? What does sentiment look like? What does the outside world see? What are some of the concerns that still persist, and how we can ensure that everything stays together? The glue within the GNU needs to stay together. Then we've got a conversation with Tsepo Kgadima, independent analyst, around the new SOE that we've gotten. Yes, it's another one. This time it is the National Petroleum Company, a merger of the Central Energy Fund, PetroSA, and a couple of other institutions. We're going to look at that, look at the memorandum of understanding that was signed through by Eskom and Sasol, and just look at the energy picture in South Africa now that we have electricity. I think we're approaching couple of months now with electricity, so going to look at that and see how we dissect that and make sense of that. Then we've got a conversation with 91 around the long-term implications of withdrawing from your two-pot, what you should know before you make those consistent withdrawals, and what the longer-term impacts could be. Then, because it's Monday, we've got personal finance on a Monday, we're going to be taking a look at wills, understanding why you need to have a will, and if you have one in place, how to protect it.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's always good to start off the week with positive news, and the markets are giving us some reasons to be positive today. We're going to start by looking at how they performed throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, that's Makwe Masilela, to take a look at the movements and try and make sense of them. Dr. Masilela, good evening. Lovely as always to catch up with you. The resources sector surprisingly starting the week on a good note, but in general, SA markets, SA equities having a really strong start.
Definitely. And evening to you, Jim, and to the listeners. And you are right, you know, kicking off the week on a positive note as market participants looked to more of interest rate cuts to help the global economy. And that's amid expectations. And maybe that is why maybe we see resources doing okay, that China may ramp up efforts to revive growth. And today we had China announcing plans for a rare top financial, what do you call it, a rare economic briefing for tomorrow by their three top financial regulators. And remember, just after cutting one of their short-term policy rates, fueling speculation that fresh stimulus is on their way. And yeah, you are right, the week, as much as it's a short week for us, tomorrow it's a holiday, but we still have important economic data, the quarterly employment numbers, your PPI on August, but I think the US Fed preferred price metric and the data on personal spending will continue to be on the radar screen. and Europe as well, the guys continued digesting manufacturing data that came in worse than expected. And that itself, Jimmy, raised expectations of aggressive rate cuts coming from the European Central Bank.
Marco, when we look at some of the movements throughout the day locally, and obviously we touched on the fact that resources led the charge there, but I'm just looking through the list of winners and losers today. There were very few kind of unexpected losers, but if we just have a look at the overall sentiment on the winners' side of it, the banks doing exceptionally well, industrials doing well, miners obviously, as we said, doing well. The skepticism that was in the market seems to kind of be now processing the fact that, okay, we're in a rate cut cycle, that China stimulus, as you said, however it shapes up, there's a lot more optimism around that. How do we make sense of where to from here? Because it has been a very long year and we still have 3 months to go.
Definitely, you know, and you are right. I mean, we've seen the rand strengthening almost 0.9% against the dollar. I mean, that managed to help our financials because we know they tend to benefit when that has to happen. But I think some of the Fed speakers as well. I mean, so far we had the Fed chairperson from Chicago. He made it very clear that they've managed to win the battle when it comes to inflation because it is going to their 2% target. So now they have to make sure that they continue to cut in order to save the labor market. So that's the message that the markets is getting, that as much as we might not get another 50 basis points cut, but definitely will continue to see cuts. The numbers that we just spoke about coming from Europe, the manufacturing numbers, that itself is putting pressure on the European Central Bank. And then China as well, they did manage to cut. We don't know what they'll be saying tomorrow. But markets are all saying that, listen, rate cuts are here, so most probably we will avoid the recession and we can probably end with a soft landing, which is the worst case scenario, and not overlooking the fact that there's a possibility that we can even have something far much better than soft landing. So global markets continue to cheer up all these things. Hence, we see, you know, even locally managing to get some record highs here and there. But we all know, Jimmy, nothing goes up in a very straight line. So one must not be surprised now and then when we see like people taking profits, you know, stuff like that. But as it stands now, if we don't get any funny surprises, things seem to be okay. Look, the whole of last week, the JSE was up almost 2.2%. So at this rate, at this pace, probably one would expect the JSE to at least continue to have a very decent week.
Speaking of those having a decent week, we got a SENS announcement from the guys at Grand Parade, the investment holding firm that used to hold Baskin-Robbins, Burger King, a couple of other assets within that portfolio. They did exceptionally well. What did they have to say?
And the group is now exclusively focused on the gaming sector. As you said, they got rid of stuff like that. The profits, as I said, any special up 650%. And that was due to the reduction of the cost of the restructuring transactions associated with the exit of the non-core investments. Dividend per share up almost 15% to 11.5 cents per share, but the revenue was flat at 1.4 million.
How do we make sense of the performance around the increase in earnings? I mean, it's a significant increase. Is it coming off of a low base? Are there some significant improvements from a business's perspective? I'm looking at some of the numbers, and I mean, the headline profit number seems to be rather impressive. But at the same time, it could be that the previous challenges put them at a very low base.
Coming from a very low base, and as we said, those costs, the transactional cost for the restructuring, are no longer there. So the guys, you can say they're now more slim or leaner and focusing on at least one sector. And now one would be able as well going forward to be able to evaluate them against their peers. But as we're saying, it's because of all those huge costs. I mean, it's not only a Baker King's, you know, they also had to unbundle Spare at some point. So the guys are now more focused on that. And yes, those costs were kind of high at some point.
Well, we'll have to see how that shapes up. There's certainly a lot to look at within the markets. And as Mark West said, it's going to likely be a very positive week if we keep up the momentum that we've kicked off the week with, even with the public holiday tomorrow. I think we'll leave it at that, Mark West. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Mark West Masilela, Chief Investment Officer at Mark West Fund Managers, on how the markets have been moving throughout the day, the sense of optimism that we start the new week on, and where it could lead us.
Welcome to the Hive Group, where innovation meets communication and technology fuels our creativity. We merge precision and brand communication through analytics, data, insights, and technology. Doing more, faster, from developing CRM systems and immersive online experience to automating content and social media marketing. The Hive Group. Communicate, elevate, innovate.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As the Government of National Unity celebrates 100 days in, we're going to be taking a look at some interesting reflections around what's happened in the last 100 days, what's been achieved, what the state of the South African economy looks like, and where to from here. I'm joined on the line by CEO at Business Unity South Africa, Kaz Kuvaria, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Uncle Kaz, good evening. Lovely to speak to you as always. Last time you and I spoke was around the announcement that we could potentially be looking at this kind of government, and we spoke about the need for some positive decision making and some real strong decision making to get us through a very interesting transitionary period. 100 days later, how are we feeling at the moment?
Thanks for having me, and hi to your listeners. Look, we are, as Busa, guardedly positive. We think that, firstly, I must say that you know, post the elections, I think the parties in the Government of National Unity, particularly the ANC, DA, and the IFP, acted in an admirable way and put country above party politics and took the decision to join the GNU. The ANC initiated those discussions and took the decision to initiate discussions on a GNU, and I think all of that was very admirable, and we must recognize that from all those political parties. I think what's positive is that the GNU is still there. There's been cabinet meetings, there's been other meetings, and through that they've come out together as the GNU. I think that some of the parties have begun to see where compromises need to be made, so as to keep the GNU together and to grow it and to strengthen it. We've seen positive sort of energy coming from a number of ministers, and not just new ministers, but even ministers who were there before. So, you know, the Minister of Home Affairs has been quite energetic and positive in trying to get visa backlogs dealt with, and other matters. He's taking very seriously the digitalization of the systems and processes at Home Affairs. Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition Park Stau, we've had very, very fruitful meetings with him, and very keen on working with business and enabling business to walk side by side with the department, because it is the department that promotes trade and industry, and we need to get manufacturing and other aspects of our economy going. And there are the ministers who are showing a lot of energy and wanting to do the right thing. I think the president has been good at holding this together, at driving the GNU, and making sure that we do continue to, as the GNU, continue to send the message that they are putting country first, and that they made positive comments about the future of the GNU. So all of that is good, I think. And finally, I think that investor confidence has picked up. Confidence in the country has picked up, undoubtedly. I know that we were involved in working with Minister Tao on the delegation he led to the U.S. for AGOA. And the response to the GNU, even from people on Congress on the Hill in the USA, was very positive. And both the minister and his deputy led the delegation very well, professionally and together. So all of those are positive. I think what we need to guard against is that given all this positive and given the increase in confidence in the country, I think we need to guard against either messaging or legislation that actually again raise concerns amongst investors about our country. So the one is obviously the national health insurance. I mean, we've indicated that we met the president last week and we've agreed that we'll be giving him information, and on the basis of that we will engage. But we would urge that rhetoric around legislation like that is managed. Then there's the Bella Act, which has also raised some concern. The president has agreed to, over a period of 3 months, engage on certain sections of the act, and that's positive, and that's why I think our view that the president is holding this together. And I think that what we need to guard against is that we don't do anything that actually goes applied in the face of the confidence that is being built.
We're going to leave that part of the conversation there, because we're going to take some reflections from Professor Raymond Parsons, who is of the Northwest University School for Business and Governance, on some of those sentiments shared by Kaz Kuvaria. The rest of that conversation is going to be up on our podcast and on our online platforms. But I'm joined on the line now by Professor Raymond Parsons to take a look at this. Good evening, Professor Parsons. Lovely to speak to you again. The guarded or guardedly positive sentiments that were echoed there by the CEO of Business Unity South Africa, how does that line up with the policy uncertainty index that you put out? I know you do this on a quarterly basis, and we often look at this as a barometer of measuring just how uncertain or certain the investors and sentiment might be feeling around policy. How are we feeling at the moment from a policy perspective?
Well, yes, good evening to you. And I think I could say at the outset that I certainly share the cautious optimism that has been expressed by my good friend Kaz Kuvaria from BUSA. I think we have a very good platform from which to launch a much better economic performance for South Africa and the job-rich growth that we want in the years ahead. I think the important point, just coming immediately to our policy uncertainty index, for the first time now, of course, we've been able to see it decline quite significantly in the past quarter, simply because of the better news, not only on the political front through the government of national unity, but also that we've been without load shedding since March of this year. So the combination of that of those two factors has really, in a measurable and a calibrated way, brought the chronic uncertainty in policy almost into positive territory. But as we've said, and as Kaz has said, look, we've got to build on this. We mustn't be complacent. We've got to understand that what commitments we've made must be seen to be implemented, must become irreversible in the minds of investors. So issues such as Operation Vulindlela, which is engaged with infrastructure development, is now moving into local government. There was reference to the Bella legislation, which once again will be discussed further. The NHI legislation will be discussed further. In regard to the Transnet developments, there's going to be a fresh look at the rules of engagement of the private sector. This might all sound incremental, but that's how change works in a changing situation like this, where you have a government of national unity that is still in its honeymoon period, as we like to put it. So the important message that I think emerges from both what Kaz Kuvaria and myself have said is that the government of national unity and the private sector want to see the country staying on the right economic track. We must make the growth-friendly changes irreversible. And bear in mind, there's another big test coming next month with our mini-budget, which will be the first GNU mini-budget. And there we will face certain fiscal challenges. and important decisions have to be taken. So I think the bottom line is, yes, we are expecting, as the Reserve Bank has indicated, 1% growth this year and maybe 1.5% to 2% next year. But all this hinges on us implementing what we've said we've done, knowing that even 1% to 2% growth is very inadequate. But it's a base on which we can now build with a much better national and business mood, which the GNU must help to translate into positive action.
Prof, the president is currently in the United States, and he's made it very clear to the United States investment community that we are open for business. From a policy perspective, from a sentiment perspective, would you agree with those sentiments?
Absolutely. I think the government of national unity, through the president, has said more than once, what is the overriding aim? And this has emerged from our discussion now this evening. It is to maximize inclusive job-rich growth. You can only do that if you get, in particular, total investment. That means infrastructure on the one side and, of course, the private sector on the other, to work together and to create an environment in which we will ensure that our private investment will respond in ways that will give us the job-rich economic growth we want. It's got to eventually boil down to accepting, as we're already seeing in certain ways, an engagement, a much bigger engagement, and a much necessary recognition that we are not going to get that growth unless we engage with the private sector on a much bigger scale and ensure that it plays the part of doing a lot of the heavy lifting that the country needs in order to deal with unemployment, poverty, and inequality in a more successful way over the next few years.
Those growth prospects, some analysts have pegged them between 1% and 3%. Are we being too optimistic by saying we can achieve 3%, or is it more around having the right cocktail and the right mix so that we can all push towards that target together?
I don't mind us being aspirational as long as we are indeed realistic. An important point made also by the governor of the Reserve Bank, that he is saying that unless we ensure that the structural economic reforms upon which we've embarked, but there's a lot of unfinished business there, as Cass has indicated, that if we do that, we can do better. But the point is, we've got to understand that on the one hand, we have to manage expectations sensibly. On the other hand, we must maximize this opportunity of a new look from a governance point of view, together with the private sector, that this economy will now at last unlock its true potential rather than be trapped in a low-go trap as we have been for the last few years. That's the challenge, and I think we have a great opportunity now between the government of national unity on the one hand and the private sector on the other to turn the situation in around that will, at the end of the day, not only make investors happy, but make our general population feel there is hope and that things will get better for them in their daily lives.
It's time to rise to the occasion for the benefit of South Africa. I think we'll leave it at that, Prof. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Professor Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business and Governance sharing his thoughts on the 100 days of the Government of National Unity and where we go from here.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's coming up to 6:30. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and we're taking a look at the latest state-owned entity. It is called the South African National Petroleum Company. As always, when we look at these energy matters, I joined on the line by our energy expert, independent analyst Tsepo Khadima, to take a look at this, try and make sense of it, and see what it's all about. Good evening, Tata Khadima. Thanks so much for taking the time. Another SOE, but this one seems to be taking in all of the good parts of the other ones. What do you make of it?
Well, good evening, Mr. Miaha, as well as to the listeners of MoneyWeb. Look, the merger, as they call it, of the three entities to bring them into one, effectively creating a national oil company, it's a step in the right direction. However, what is not yet clear at the moment is in terms of really the core activities that this new entity will be involved in. Is it going to be in the liquid fuels market, or is it going to be energy much more broadly? And if it is going to be in energy much more broadly, one wonders as to how it then got excluded from the recently announced joint venture between Eskom and Sasol, because one would have thought that actually, you know, such a the MOU that has been signed to explore jointly the, you know, effectively increased use of natural gas or liquefied natural gas into this economy would have made more sense when you have got the three entities combined than just, let's say, you know, these three specifically state-owned companies that, after all, they fell under Central Energy Fund, they will continue to do so for some time before they go on their own and they are independent. So, but step in the right direction all the same.
So, but when we look at some of the components of putting through or putting together this new SOE, there have been very clear conversations around the fact that PetroSA as a business in its entirety wasn't a viable asset to add into this new state-owned entity, but only some of their components. I think the trading business and the Ghana asset were identified as being those that can form part of the new state-owned entity. Are we reworking all of these other components and saying we're putting together a really good asset in the form of this SANPC for the purposes of overall beneficiation in the energy space? How are you seeing kind of just the way in which it's been put together?
Look, I mean, in the first instance, I'm surprised that they think that the trading business is a lot more viable business or the Ghana business. The Ghana business, Petro SA, at the last valuation, I think they, in terms of the production sharing agreement there, the interest there was only 7% of that field. So it's minute in real terms. And that oil field itself is not one of the largest recently discovered deposits. And at the time, Petro SA, when they acquired it with a lot of debt from their commercial banks. And I think, you know, that has been, you know, a problem for some time, actually on the balance sheet of Petro SA itself. When you look at the trading business has largely been predicated on one customer, and that customer being Eskom, by and large, because Petro SA does not have effectively the infrastructure in terms of storage terminals where it could be importing fuel, liquefied petroleum or liquid fuels such as diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, and paraffin, which it could then successfully, distribute to the retailers, to the forecourts of various other players. So in a way, I think for some time, it will remain a small business. One would have thought that perhaps maybe a viable strategy would have been to say, how do they then make the best use of the intellectual property, a patent of the Fischer-Tropsch gas to liquids technology? Because in the last 10 years, I'm aware, because when I was chairman there, I signed the checks to develop a technology in terms of the low temperature Fischer-Tropsch technology for gas to liquids. And one would have thought that actually the best thing would have been for this new entity, SANPEC, to be a global champion, taking advantage of the patent on the Fischer-Tropsch technology of gas to liquids, to actually become a global player than being inward focused, because the market here is a big market, but in the greater scheme of things, it is not the biggest market. And the barrier to entry for this new entity, Sanpec, unfortunately, it is still high, because the incumbents, particularly in the liquid fuel space, pretty much entrenched, and I can't see how they would be able to make success of it. And as I say, one would have thought that they should have really, at this juncture, brought in the refinery business, but more for the patent, the gas to liquids technology, and actually go global. Because when I was chairman of Petro SA, that was in fact the vision that I had, that Petro SA, or Sanpec as it would now be called, should become a global champion, particularly in the area of gas to liquids, because gas itself is a very versatile fuel. There are many other products, synthetic fuels, as well as petrochemicals that you can make than perhaps maybe the recently announced joint venture, or rather a memorandum of understanding between Sasol and Eskom, which also I think paints a very intriguing but somewhat confusing picture. Hence, the share price of Sasol hasn't responded, nor the bond yields of Eskom have not responded, because it signals a departure perhaps from their core business model, when one would have thought that, as I say, bringing the three together would have been, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 7.
Well, certainly there is a lot that needs to be looked at from this perspective, but we are on the right path. We are moving in the right direction, and perhaps this is a continuation of the GNU conversation to say it's time for the public and private sectors to get on the same page so that we can move this machine forward. We'll have to leave it at that, Tsepo. Thank you as always for the time and for the insights. Lovely conversation. Tsepo Kadima, independent analyst on the latest state-owned entity, the South African National Petroleum Company, that was formed recently.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. So some interesting data has come out over the last couple of days around the number of withdrawals we've seen from the two-pot systems implementation. We've seen a couple of companies, the likes of Momentum and Sanlam, reporting on the number of withdrawals and the value of those withdrawals in excess of several billion rands. And it brought up the question around, what do we do when we look at these withdrawals from a long-term perspective? And helping me with that discussion, I'm joined on the line by the Advisor Services Director at 91, Yaku Fantondra, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Good evening, Yaku. Thanks so much for taking the time. The two-pot has clearly come in with a lot of momentum, a lot of gusto. Everybody's kind of made some decisions around whether they're accessing the savings pot or not. Let's kind of start by looking at an overview around what these changes mean for investments, what these two-pot adjustments or this change in legislation actually means for retirement planning.
Hi, Jimmy, and good evening, and thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, I think it's important that we, I mean, there's so much that's been written about the focus on the short-term withdrawals from the savings pots at the moment, where people are, you know, running to the pension funds administrators trying to get their savings component, which is 10% or 30,000 rand, whichever this is the smallest. And so there's a huge amount of noise about that. But I think all of that noise is detracting from the fact that there are some important longer term conversations that we need to have about, you know, retirement funds and 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now. I think there are some key questions around which products are the right products now for investors going forward, because there's been some substantial changes to the rules of a number of products, specifically the retirement annuity, which has now become basically the same as a company pension fund. So there's been some interesting upgrades that have happened hidden behind the scenes of the two-pot regulations. And then there are some important questions about how do you invest your retirement fund now in the two-pot world? Should it be different? Should it be the same? And I think there are some longer term questions that people need to think about. If you take out your savings component on a regular basis, you know, understanding what the longer term implication of that is going to be on your retirement one day. So I think some important long term discussions that I think is high time that we start having them with the public.
Jaco, let's look at that savings aspect of it. That's probably been where a lot of the focus has been recently around. Do I access my savings? Do I not? Do I kind of defer withdrawing from my savings? How do we navigate that? And I think a lot of that conversation has been centered around the implications of withdrawing from your savings come the 1st of September. Let's fast forward a couple of years, because at the moment, everybody can withdraw 30,000 Rand. That's the maximum that would have been allocated towards that savings pot at this stage. But how does that 30,000 Rand look sort of 3, 4, maybe 5 years from now, having combined itself with your contributions from the 1st of September and having grown and compounded over 3 or 4 years? How does that amount look, and how does that affect your retirement planning if you're looking to withdraw that kind of an amount?
So I think that is a really good point. I mean, even though a lot of people are drawing 30,000 Rand amounts or 10% of their fund values, if you look at the absolute value of that in terms of your larger pension plan, it still is a fairly small amount of money at the moment. But it's so the savings components at the moment has gotten small balances from the seeding, and that is what people are busy withdrawing. But the bigger conversation is that in 5, 6, 7, 8 years' time from now, people would have contributed, because a third of your monthly pension fund contributions in future is going to go into the savings account. So the savings component is going to grow quite rapidly. And so for many people, they are likely to find that roughly a third of your pension fund value is going to be housed in your savings component, in the next 4 or 5 years. And so the amount of money that will be available for withdrawal is going to be quite significant. So the damage to be done to your long-term prospects from drawing your 15 or 20 or 30,000 Rand today is actually much more limited. The real damage that you could potentially do is when people start drawing 100 and 200 and 300 and 400,000 Rand every 2 or 3 years from their savings components, which they will be able to do in a few years' time. The impact of that is much more significant, because effectively you are cutting your contribution rate to your pension fund by roughly a third, because you're taking about a third of your contribution out every 2 or 3 years. And that has got a dramatic impact on your what we call the replacement ratio at retirement. It's basically the proportion of your salary that you earned before retirement that you can replace from your pension income. And the ideal for that number is to be in the region of at least 75%. So if you're earning 100,000 Rand before retirement per annum, you want to be able to earn at least 75,000 Rand after you've gone on pension. That's kind of a safe international norm. And if people empty their pots regularly on the two-pot system, what they're going to find is that, in effect, they're going to be ending up with closer to a 50% replacement ratio. And that's going to be not enough for the bulk of people. So I think that's an important component for people to understand as kind of the primary impact of withdrawing regularly from your savings pot. And then there are other ancillary components that you need to be mindful of. I think people on higher tax brackets need to be reminded that it will be an expensive withdrawal. So you're paying a significant amount of income tax if you're on the higher income tax brackets. And also that there could be an impact over time. You might not be aware of this, but financial advisors most definitely will, that when people retire, there are some really good lump sum tax concessions that are available to people who go on pension when they retire one day. So SARS gives you a once-off opportunity at retirement to get a fair amount of your pension fund out as a lump sum tax-free, actually. So that's a really, really good dispensation. But if you get to retirement and you've spent all your lump sums by withdrawing it from your savings component during your lifetime, none of those good tax advantages will be available to you. So these are all the hidden costs in the long term of withdrawing from your savings pots on a regular basis. And that's why we generally actively discourage these types of withdrawals unless you really have a true financial emergency.
Yaku, what you're saying about that replacement ratio really worries me, because effectively having missed that replacement ratio means, one, your retirement funds won't last you as long as initially planned, but two, if you are to have those funds still stick around or stretch, it means the asset manager or the fund manager or the guardians responsible for ensuring that those funds grow over time have a much harder job. Take me through the impact that these kinds of withdrawals then have on investment strategy. Does it then mean that if I had previously been in a different kind of risk portfolio or risk tolerance towards my retirement, I might have to rethink that because I've got more money to make up for?
Well, I think the knife actually cuts both ways. I mean, because this is now, when it comes to the construction of an investment portfolio in the two-pot world, you now obviously find the big impact is human behavior. Behavioral finance is always at play when people make investments. It's the fear and the greed factors. And so what you're going to sit with is you're going to sit with, I guess, two types of problems. The first problem is that people might think that they're going to be investing their savings components in fixed income because they're going to be drawing it regularly. So if their departure point is, I'm going to be withdrawing from my savings component on average every 2 years, they're going to be investing that savings component a lot more conservatively, and that means they have less equities in their portfolio. Now, your savings pot is a third of your pension fund contributions. So if you're going to be investing a third of your contributions in some cash equivalent or income fund style product, which does not provide long-term inflation beating returns, you're cutting your growth assets in your portfolio down from 70 to 75%, which is what Regulation 28 allows. You're cutting it down to something like closer to 60 or 65%. And that could knock a full percent per annum investment return off your portfolio. So that is a very real fear that we have, is that the expectation of drawing regularly from your savings component is going to get some people to actually invest in a different way, which has a secondary knock-on effect on their portfolio's long-term investment performance. The other challenge that you could face is that people try and invest the opposite way. So they try and be too aggressive in their equity component to make up for the fixed income piece that they've got in their savings pot. Now, luckily, Regulation 28 does make sure that the portfolio overall doesn't take excessive risk. But it is possible that people could try and push those boundaries to try and make up for it. So it's difficult to predict exactly how people are going to respond, and different people are likely to respond differently. But I think there's definitely an impact on how the portfolios are constructed. And I know that some asset consultants in the pension funds industry are scratching their heads around what the best way is to construct the portfolio for long-term growth, but at the same time to manage the behavioral finance biases of the members of the fund as well. Very tricky situations to deal with these.
Certainly a lot to consider, but more than anything else, have conversations with your teams, have conversations with your financial advisor, with your asset manager, with your retirement planner, and make sure you understand the actual implications that this could potentially have on your retirement. It's nice to have access to these funds. It's nice to have a bit of freedom and flexibility around these things, but be very, very careful before you make those decisions. We'll leave it at that. Yaku, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Yaku van Tonder, who is Advisor Services Director at 91 on the longer term implications of withdrawing from your savings pot. This feature was brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change.
What will you leave behind one day? Whether you're building a life for your children, building an empire, or both, your future starts with the right investment partner. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's personal finance time on a Monday. We're taking a look at the importance of a will. It is Wills Month this month, so we're going to take a look at this and try and see why we should have one in place. I'm joined on the line by Rehana Kasim, who is the fiduciary specialist at PPS, that's the Professional Provident Society, to take a look at this and try and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Rehana. Thanks so much for taking the time. Why do I need to have a will in place?
Hi, good evening, Jimmy. Thank you so much for inviting me to your show and giving us the opportunity to obviously, share some knowledge with you guys. And the question is, why is the will important? It's important because it ensures that your assets are distributed, according to your wishes when you pass away. Because if there is no will in place, then it might be that, the wishes that you or the intentions that you have will not align, it will not be executed. And the will also obviously gives you the opportunity to appoint executor of your choice. You can name your guardian for your minor children, and then you can obviously make specific bequests, right? So it gives you that opportunity to sort of show your loved ones that you leave behind one day that you, that continuous care and support for their welfare after you are gone.
Rihanna, when I'm looking to set up a will, is there a particular time to do it? Is it one of those things that is best done sooner rather than later? And how do I go about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, a will, people will ask you, when is a good time? Like you said, when is a good time to set up that will? There is not really a good time or the best time, because it's the time when you find yourself in your circumstances. Right? Where do you find yourself in your circumstances? What is your family dynamic? What is it that you have acquired so far? And what would you like to leave to your loved ones? The step for obviously setting up the will, or the first step that someone will take to make sure that will is drafted correctly, is to gather all the necessary information that will compile this document. You will list your assets. You will look at what type of assets you have. Is it a bank account? Is it car? Is it a car? Is it a house? My personal possessions. And when I say that, it can be that the person that's sitting, that's now drafting the will, might only have money in the bank and maybe some personal items, but you want to ensure that those two, the money in the bank and the personal items, go to the people that he would love them to go to, right? So it can happen at any time in your life, basically. However, for a person to draft a will, you need to be 16 and older. So we look at, at that age, basically. At any point in time when you feel there is this specific need in your life, to sit down, look at your assets, making sure who are your beneficiaries, and then make those bequests. That is the time that you will do it.
Rihanna, when we look at the will process and the drafting of the will, what do I need to put in the will to ensure that my wishes are respected and executed upon in the manner that I wanted them to be?
Yeah, so what will you put in that will to make sure? Like I said, firstly, you have to identify your assets. What is it that I have, right? So, and who are my beneficiaries? Who are the heirs that I would want to inherit from me the day that I'm no longer there? So the process is, look at your list of assets, look at your beneficiaries or your heirs, and then put it down on a piece of paper. But we always advise to do that process should be done with expert guidance and support. Everyone can, download a template from the internet, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those lines that you put on that piece of paper will be executable. So the process is not just looking at your assets, but also looking at liabilities and costs, and making sure that when I bequeath my estate, that there's actually sufficient liquidity as well to cover the cost, and then the residue or the remaining of my assets will then be paid out as per the wishes in the will.
Rihanna, you mentioned something important around making sure that the correct people are put in place to execute on the will or to help you draft the will so that it does remain legally binding. We've seen a couple of concerns from people that have previously had wills drafted or wills drafted by third parties, and now you have problems claiming or now you have problems executing on that will because you need to pay for fees and all sorts of things around that. How do we navigate that? How do we ensure that the documents and the processes that we have to follow, we know as the people drafting those documents what our rights are, what our beneficiaries' rights are, and so that people actually don't struggle in the event that they need to execute the will.
Yeah, no, definitely, Jimmy, and that is why it's important to work with a, you know, a professional service, professional people that can give you that expert guidance, like PPS Fiduciary Services, or then your attorney, or then your financial advisor, to make sure that what you put in inside the will, you know, will give you peace of mind. So the benefits of working with a professional service will make sure that the professionals that will navigate you through the complex legal and financial considerations, they have that expertise, right? They can guide you. They can give you tailored advice. They can look at your specific family dynamic. They can look at your specific circumstances and then provide that ongoing support when it's needed to update and review your will as your life circumstances change. And also what a professional service will also help you with is to store that original will, right? Because it's important that when you pass away, that when we report the estate at the master's office, the master still requires the original copy of that signed will. So that is why safe storage, secure storage options should also be part of that service that your trusted provider will provide you with.
Rihanna, you mentioned something about having the will or having the will kept up to date. Why do I need to have that in place? Why can I not just draft a will once, put it away safely, as you mentioned, and just never look at it? Does having an outdated will create a problem?
Yeah, definitely. An updated will result in, firstly, your wishes not being what you are wanting it intend to be, right? It can also lead to, if there is no updated will or the will is not, or there is no will in place, that intestate succession will then be applied to your estate. And what does intestate succession mean? It means that there's a piece of legislation, the Intestate Succession Act, stipulates and regulates actually who are the people that will inherit. So the executor or the person that will administer your estate cannot, there's no leeway. You need to follow the rules and the regulations in the Intestate Succession Act. And also, by not having an updated will in place, it can also lead to family disputes, right? An outdated or unclear will can lead to confusion, disputes among family members, and even, you know, it can lead to costly legal battles. And the most important thing is it can lead to delays in the estate administration, because it might be that no executor was appointed in the will, and therefore the loved ones that you leave behind will now have to, among themselves, nominate an executor and then find someone to actually administer this estate.
Rihanna, you mentioned something about keeping will safe. Are there things I can do if we've got a family will or we're dealing with a case in the family and the original document has been lost? Is there a way we can verify the authenticity of a will? In some cases, the document might not be lost, or we might have two different versions of the will. How do we authenticate which one to execute on?
Yeah, so that's very important to me. I mean, that is where the master's office and the court will then obviously make that decision. So say, for argument's sake, the client passes away, the deceased person has left a will behind, but the example that you use, there's two copies that surfaced after his death. Then it will then be the court that will have to decide, right? It will be a court application to decide which one of those two is actually the latest one and the valid one. So that is why it's important to make sure that once the will is signed, that it is actually stored in a secure location, whether it's a safe, whether it's with a trusted service provider, that trusted service provider actually has access to that, because it's not a process. The master's office, once, say for argument's sake, there is a situation where two wills surface after the person has passed away, the master's office will then have to obviously make a decision in terms of which one of the two is valid. But that normally ends up in a court case. The court will have to decide based on the evidence presented at in court as to which one will then be the valid will that gives effect to the intentions of the deceased person. The master's office won't necessarily accept or by default accept a copy of that original signed will. And that is why it's important that safe storage ensures that your will is accessible when it's required, and it reduces the risk of misplacement and that it can be contested after death.
The real question here is, what are you willing to do to protect your family and to ensure that your loved ones are looked after you are gone? We'll leave it at that, Rehana. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Rehana Kasim, who is the fiduciary specialist at PPS, joining me to take a look at having a will in place. It's just gone 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, tomorrow we've got a special show lined up for you, so be sure to tune into that show. But until then, good night.